With infinite complacence, people went to and fro over the earth about their little affairs, serene in the assurance of their dominion over this small, spinning fragment of solar driftwood, which by chance or design, man has inherited out of the dark mystery of time and space.
Why don't you ask me what it feels like to be a freak?
The power of a new generation.
Greetings, and you are listening to Savage Science Radio here at Jackalope 105 FM, and I am your host, Tracy Savage. Remember when you were a little kid and they told you to be good? Little did you know that was an evolutionary benefit for survival. Tonight's special lecture is from Dr. Dacher Keltner. He is a professor of psychology at the University of California, Berkeley, as well as the director for Greater Good Science Center, formerly known as the Center for the Development of Peace and Well-Being. And this particular lecture is his talk, The Compassionate Instinct, a Darwinian Tale of Survival of the Kindness. Without much further ado, here is Dr. Dacher Keltner, PhD.
Thank you so much, Jim. It's terrific to be back here at Stanford after all these years. It's very, very, very moving to be here at this wonderful place. I am grateful to see Mark Lepper, one of my advisors in graduate school. I'm grateful to see Phil Zimbardo, one of my inspirations in graduate school, who was a phenomenon on the softball field, stirring up all kinds of trouble. One of my oldest friends in the science of human emotion, James Gross, is here. I have honors students here, friends, and even my niece, who's an undergrad here. I couldn't persuade her to go to Cal. With the best of offerings on Telegraph Ave, just did not persuade her. But that's life. And it's great to speak here on behalf of Compassion and C-Care and all the great work that it's doing. So it's really good to be here. In his book, Humanity, the historian Jonathan Glover writes about a regularity on the battlefield that may surprise you, which is soldiers in the heat of combat become overwhelmed by sympathy breakthroughs. Much as Phil Zimbardo can create antisocial behavior in a laboratory at Stanford, on the battlefield, in the heat of combat, facing your adversaries, soldiers just break down at the contact of human beings that they're going to hurt. This is a regularity in wartime. One of the great examples was the essayist George Orwell, who was trained to kill fascists and was fighting in Spain against the fascist cause. He had a fascist in his sights. The guy was running through the streets of Spain. He had him ready to shoot, and he just could not pull the trigger. And he said that there was something about the humanity of the individual, his skin, his eyes, his face running by, that short-circuited that tendency. A more well-known example, or more dramatic example, is that which occurred in the Holocaust in one of the concentration camps. An attending doctor in a gas chamber, Miklos Nisley, discovered a young teen girl who was at the bottom of a big pile of bodies. She was alive, and the attending staff just reflexively transcended their ideology and tended to her, offered her broth, offered her a coat, wanted to hide her away, and then the commandant who was there decided to have her killed by shooting her in the back of the head. Glover contends that this is just a uniformity of battle, is this overwhelming feeling of sympathy. In fact, estimates from different historical accounts say that even in the heat of battle, 75% of people, up till World War II, refused to shoot at the enemy. They could not pull the trigger. It is wired into our nervous systems, even in contexts you would predict otherwise. Now, evolutionary thought, and what really inspired me to generate the science I'm going to tell you about tonight and write some of the books and the like. Very interestingly, evolutionary thought has had a lot of trouble thinking about the deep origins of compassion and altruism and the things that are studied at C-Care. And in fact, as Helena Cronin documents, it was a very deep controversy in the field. Evolutionists started to kind of make advances in understanding human morphology and physical structures and even some social behaviors. But when they got to human goodness, the theorists really split. Alfred Russel Wallace, the co-discoverer of human evolution, was a spiritualist, and he really felt when it came to matters of altruism and kindness that those are really the providence of God. They were put into human beings by God, by metaphysical forces. Thomas Huxley, the popularizer of Charles Darwin, really made the case that really is quite common in the social sciences, which is that there is no way in a survival of the fittest situation that compassion could be built into the nervous system. Instead, it's a social construct, right? It is a social contract that we arrive at in our cultures. It's a cultural construction. And by the way, as many of you probably know, survival of the fittest is not Darwin's term. It's Herbert Spencer, who came after Darwin and had a very cynical view of human nature. One of the great things about doing the science of compassion is to read Darwin closely, founding figure in the science of human emotion. And Darwin had a much different view of human nature that he started to articulate in Descent of Man, 1871, and then in The Expression of Emotion in Man and Animals. Adam Gopnik has written beautifully about kind of the Darwinian view of human nature, and I think a signature event was that his beloved daughter, one of many children he lovingly cared for, died prematurely. And he, because his wife Emma couldn't handle the grieving or the bereavement process, he really took care of her to her dying day and had this deep encounter with suffering. And out of that, Darwin argued that sympathy will have increased through natural selection for these communities, which include the greatest number of the most sympathetic members, would flourish the best and would raise the greatest number of offspring. Such a sensible, flat-footed, sound perspective on different selection processes that could give rise to compassion. Turns out it was ignored for 130 years. Now, there are very sound reasons why compassion should be part of our DNA, it should be part of our brains, it should be part of the human design. It took some female primatologists to bring this to the evolutionary theories attention. And people started to make a very simple observation about the nature of offspring, which is that these are offspring of our closest primate relatives, the beloved bonobo on the left. How many of you have heard of the bonobo? That's right, you probably read Franz de Waal. They kind of act like those people, those polyamorous societies on Haight-Ashbury. They use sex for everything. When you read about the bonobos, you're like, I want to join the bonobo species, but you can't. And then there are the there's a chimpanzee on the left. These are young babies. They're doing a few things that are really unusual. When you compare them to human babies, they're feeding themselves, they're sitting upright, they're navigating the environment somewhat independently. People estimate that human offspring are the most vulnerable offspring on the face of the earth. They take 7 to 51 years to reach the age of independence. And I have to, as the economy tanks, I have to adjust that estimate, you know, because some of you have your kids living in the basement or whatever it is. And that's because, very raw morphological fact, which is that as we started to walk upright, our pelvises narrowed. As we fell in love with poetry and art and metaphor, our brains expanded, and we're born wildly prematurely, as any young parent will, with some tragic sense in their voice, I would tell you. That simply says, as Sarah Blaffer-Hurdy has argued, this simple fact, the nature of our offspring, rearranged our social structures, as studies of hunter-gatherer cultures will tell you, and it rearranged our nervous systems and our emotion profiles, which I'll talk about here. So I'm really interested in providing data for you that really speak to the Darwinian story about how compassion really evolved into our nervous system and then into our social structures and became part of the human social fabric. And it really has a couple of very simple ideas that have been wrestled with and grappled with in game theory and evolutionary modeling and signaling behavior in non-human species and the like. It really flows out of the sensible idea we've evolved a caregiving system, which I'll talk about. What we presuppose is that for compassion to become an evolutionarily stable strategy, part of our human character, it really should have a reliable signal to it so other people can detect you, form cooperative relationship with you. Secondly, it really should be contagious. It should spread quickly to others, again, to stimulate and evoke cooperative relationships where you won't be exploited. This is just kind of giving you the evolutionary framework. And then finally, you know, if we are serious about an evolutionary analysis of compassion, let's just look at whether it fares well as a trait in classic evolutionary outcomes, the best that we can look at in contemporary humans. All right, so let me tell you about the reliability of this signal. And Jim said I work with Paul Ekman, and this owes homage to that collaboration. As many of you know, one of the great, and Darwin is at the heart of this discovery, the wonderful spectrum of many emotions is universal. There are a couple hundred studies of studying people around the world, and you can see this upper right photographic sequence of somebody from sub-Saharan Africa, and you watch them, and this, you know, and they're laughing at a joke in the upper right corner, and then they start to realize that the joke is about them, and then if you look at that bottom left corner, they're getting teased, and they show to the millisecond the facial displays of embarrassment that I've spent 10 perverse years in my lab studying, and it is exactly the same. It's part of our human register. So wouldn't it be interesting if compassion had a facial signature? There are studies showing that that display right there on the bottom right with the oblique eyebrows, which is very hard to fake, actually happens when people feel compassionate and signals altruistic behavior in kids and adults. This is work by Nancy Eisenberg. I was excited by this discovery. I took photos of this person with oblique eyebrows. I went to different parts of the world, like the Philippines and India and the like. I showed these photos expecting to discover a universal signal of compassion. That's the photo I showed. And instead, people would say things like, she looks a little confused, she's doing a crossword puzzle, I think she's constipated. It didn't work, and that was a failure. But thankfully, failures are informative in science. It's a humbling endeavor. So I turned to something that is a miracle of emotional communication, which is the human voice. Our vocal capacities, we're starting to find in our lab, convey more emotion than the face. Compared to other primate relatives, our voice is much more articulated and developed and is a more sophisticated system. It still gives me goosebumps to think that as the brain stimulates muscle contractions around your lungs, bursts of air particles go through your vocal folds. Those get these vibratory patterns that then travel through your mouth and then can emerge in laughter and sarcasm and motherese, where we use a special tone of voice for little babies and cute faces. It is an incredible register of emotion. So we asked a simple question. Maybe the reliable signal of compassion is in the voice, is this tone or this character that we can communicate to others our pro-social intentions. And we've studied, and this is Emiliana, and a lot of the science is Emiliana's doing. We studied these things called vocal bursts, which I think are some of the oldest vocalizations in the human repertoire, millions of years old in evolution. And they are short sounds by which we communicate emotion, really short, resonant sounds. So I'm going to test you guys. I know it's late in the afternoon, and I'm going to see how good you guys are. This is a sound that I heard recently from my 13-year-old daughter. You guys ready? See if you know what emotion I'm trying to communicate. Right? Now, if I use words, that's like, oh, she's dismissively arrogant and yet again contemptuous of her dad, which is justifiably so. My hair hasn't changed since high school, and I don't know why. But when I do that sound to anybody in the world, they laugh and they go, don't let her do that again, right? And so Emiliana really wanted to capture this language of emotion through these little short vocal bursts. We had people do vocal bursts. Other people judge what was happening in that vocal burst, what emotion was happening. And what we find, I apologize for the misspelled interest there, what you find, which is really quite incredible, is we have this great vocal register to communicate pro-social emotion, right? Amusement, 90% accurate on the axis where chance guessing is 8%. I'm starting a whole line of research on awe. We can communicate awe with the voice at 80% accuracy. Really interesting. Compassion comes in 50%, seven times the rate of chance. I know, all right, I know you're looking at that far right one. You're still distracted. But what the heck about love? I thought I had it, man. You know. Well, you don't. There's no vocal signature for love. So, I wish you the best of luck. So I'm gonna test you again. The count of three. I want to hear all of your compassion vocal bursts. See how good you guys are. One, two, three. There we go. You guys pass. Okay. When we add all of the amazing modalities of communication that Darwin described in an act of genius in the expression of emotion in man and animals, you can get compassion up as a reliable signal in different parts of the world, 70 to 80%, as a very important social signal. Lots of good data on that. So the second idea, and this comes out of people who are trying to model the spread of goodness with game theory techniques and mathematical techniques. You should consult the work of James Fowler, UC San Diego, Christakis at Harvard, Novak at Harvard, very interested in this, how goodness spreads, is the idea that if competitive self-interest is the default, and a sensible default, you know, given all of its rationale, one of the ways in which pro-social tendencies can take hold in social groups, small social groups, like those in which we evolved, is it can be viral. It can spread really quickly, right? And there are really interesting new data that speak to the contagious nature of compassion. Neonates, well known for several decades, cry at other neonates' distress calls, but not their own. We've been studying how the pro-social tendencies at the physiological level, and James Gross has been working a little bit on this as well, spread to other people unconsciously and contagiously. John Hyatt and others have shown really powerful data that all I have to do is see some individual I've never met act in a compassionate way, and you get this pang, this emotion Thomas Jefferson called elevation, that drives you to pro-social behavior. Fowler and Christakis are doing these wonderful studies showing, you know, in iterative game theory paradigms, one act of goodness, as we all knew, spreads down to subsequent generations of individuals who never meet the first generator of the act of goodness, right? We kind of knew that. There are funny studies where I can take an individual, unbeknownst to them, and they're in kind of an area of an organization that doesn't give a lot to charity, and I plunk them down in a different part of the organization, and suddenly that's more altruistic, and suddenly they're giving a lot more to charity. And Barbara Ehrenreich, the great social critic, has written about collective joy. Very contagious emotion. So I got interested in the contagious spreading nature of compassion by turning to one of the most ignored modalities of human communication in science, touch. And it's inexplicable why we missed it. Well, it's not inexplicable. There are good reasons for that. It's incredible what anatomy we've been endowed to make touch and tactile contact this incredible medium of emotion and compassion. Our hand is an incredible five-digit wonder, much more sophisticated than chimpanzees' hands and the great apes' hands, who are largely capable of firm grasping. We can do all kinds of incredible dexterous moves with our five hands. Even more incredible, or five fingers, excuse me. In Berkeley, we have five hands. So, even more incredible is the largest organ in your body, the skin. For those of you who are fascinated by the skin, Nina Jablonski has a great book. She works at the California Academy of Science on the skin. You know, it's 6 pounds. It's the first system that's online when babies are born. It has three layers of cells that are processing information about touch that go right to your somatosensory cortex. It's where your immune system is fighting things. What an obvious place to study the spread of goodness is through compassion. William James said touch is the alpha and omega of affection. So there's an exploding scientific literature on touch. We know that touch triggers activation in the orbital frontal cortex, a place where rewards are processed. We know that touch builds up trusting and cooperative relationships. If you know, Berkeley is overpopulated with people getting you to sign things. If they touch you, you're twice as likely to sign the dang thing. If you pat a student on the back, they're twice as likely to speak out in class. If negotiators are patted on the back, they become more cooperative. If that fellow right up there in the upper left, when it's groomed, Franz de Waal has shown, will share food systematically to the groomers later in the day. So important is touch in primates that little prosimian called the slow loris evolved one finger that it only uses to groom other slow lorises. I won't comment on that primate in the bottom right. Anyways, that slipped in there, but touch signals safety in the attachment literature. The most incredible data by people like Michael Meany are showing, and Darlene Francis, my colleague, that lots of tactile contact basically shuts down a stress response, right? It activates the counterpoint to the stress response in rat pups and humans and the like. So what an incredible language. I get up on my soapbox on this because we are a touch-deprived culture. Here's one finding to convince you. Friends talking to each other, one study found. In England, they touched each other zero times. In the United States, twice. And in Puerto Rico, 180 times in the same unit of observation. So we did this crazy study. This is Matt Hertenstein. We were interested in whether touch, you could communicate goodness and spread pro-social intentions without words, without even seeing a person, just through touch. So we had participants come to our lab in Berkeley. We build a big barrier. One person sticks their arm through the barrier. The other person is given a list of emotions. They have to reach out and touch that person on the arm and try to communicate an emotion. And then the touchy has to guess what just happened. That's a weird study. I agree. We had unethical versions of this study that I won't tell you about. Incredibly, chance guessing, 8%. They're getting it right 55% of the time. When you're allowed to let them freely touch ethical parts of the body, their accuracy jumps very high. That's another study. You can see compassion, gratitude, and love. 1 second, 2 second touches to the forearm, you can spread those emotions to others very reliably. I have to tell you about two gender differences that we observed in the study. When women tried to communicate anger to the man, he had no idea what she was doing and they got nothing right. And then when the man tried to communicate compassion to the woman, she got zero right. She had no idea what the poor fellow was trying to do. So we need more work on touch. So, my lab's gone nuts on touch. In the scientific sense, you may have heard of these findings. I had a graduate student who spoke here, Michael Krauss. Did he? I don't know if he talked about these, but he's a basketball player. I used to be before my knee surgeries. I used to guard him. He got the better of me. And we marveled at how on the basketball court, 200-pound men can bash into each other. And I've played 3,000 games of basketball, and I've never seen a punch thrown, which is less violence than my family reunions, going to the theater in Berkeley, shopping at the Berkeley Bowl, just at faculty senate meetings at campus. It is the most peaceful place in the United States. And we think it's because touch is this language of cooperation. So here's what we did. We coded all of a game in the first part of the season, in the part of the season, all teams. It took us 7 months to code all forms of touch in the game. On average, there were a couple minutes of touch total in the 48 minutes of a basketball game. This is how men express affection to each other. They do high fives, fist bumps, arm embraces. Kevin Garnett, for you Celtics fans, was the best toucher in the NBA. Bear hugs, head wraps, if you approve subtly of something that just happened on the court, wrap your partner's head, arm embraces, and then if you win, you chest bump, or you do flying hip bumps, and wouldn't it be great to see this in a faculty meeting after, or at a lab, like, we got our grant! So that's how men express compassion. And on the basketball court, and what we found, controlling for everything you'd possibly want to control for. First of all, the great players, according to Bill James-like statistics, which are various, afterwards for you basketball fans, I can talk to you about them, are better touchers. They're just distributing touch more. Kevin Garnett, sorry, I am a basketball, you have to indulge me in this. After he shoots a free throw, he touches four people in about half a second. He reaches forward, boom, boom. He goes back, boom, boom. And what we find is the more touch, both at the individual and team level, later in the season, the team plays more cooperatively, and they actually win more games, controlling for nice confounds there. So just to kind of round the corner and return to, so that's contagion. Does it pay to be good? You know, it's a slightly, you know, we think that that giving is for suckers. We think that compassion is a weak thing. The philosopher Immanuel Kant said that compassion should be ruled out of ethical judgment because it's always blind and subjective. I can give you some more quotes. You know, there's been this skepticism about the value of compassion within an evolutionary frame. And all I can tell you is a lot of good social scientific data rub up against that presupposition. So we know, you know, that more compassionate parenting produces kids who are healthier in terms of getting your genes to the next generation. We know, it turns out, that the most desirable trait worldwide in the sexual selection process that really is very important, as Jeffrey Miller has written, who's a grad of Stanford, in shaping our traits and adaptations, is compassion. These are findings from the right, very well-known findings from 1987. David Buss surveyed 37 countries, 10,000 participants. What is the most important trait, answered young adults in falling in love and setting up a romantic partnership? I'm sure he used different language than what I just uttered there. So what you see is the two sets of bars are the most famous findings, generated a lot of controversy. Women in blue value the man's financial prospects more than men. Men in red, primitive apes that they are, value beauty more than women. But around the world, there was no gender difference. They wanted kindness. And I tell this to my daughters every night at the dinner table. So that's important. There are a lot of interesting social selection data about, you know, sort of rising in social hierarchies that you actually get more status if you sacrifice and act altruistically. We can talk about that in the breaks if you like. Does it pay to be good? Well, we have been interested, as have a lot of scientific researchers like James Gross here at Stanford, in this really interesting bundle of nerves, the vagus nerve, that is what many people believe to be mammalian. It wanders through your body. It helps activate muscles that help you communicate and orient your gaze towards other people. It slows heart rate. It interdigitates with immune system response. We find that it's active during feelings of compassion and pro-social emotion more generally. If you find people that have elevated vagal tone through certain assessments, they have richer friendship networks, they're the kids on the playground who help kids in distress. Our data are showing, and I'll show you another study of this kind, people kind of immediately sense it in the person with this more activated bundle of nerves that tracks compassion. If you're around one of those people, you kind of go, I trust this woman, I trust this guy, I'll give some resources to them. We're picking it up, very interesting points. That's Paul Rusesabagina, who saved all the Tutsis in the massacre in Rwanda, and I would love to measure his vagus nerve. The other guy I'd love to measure, but I can't, is Walt Whitman. I think his vagus nerve was it was pathological. Anyway, yeah, that's neither. But. So Emiliana Simon-Thomas and others in my lab have gotten really interested in, well, let's start to map compassion in the nervous system, and that's what CCARE is really doing. And you can get people to respond to images of suffering, like these. Triggers vagus nerve activation. We've got several studies showing that. It activates, very interestingly, Emiliana is just about to publish this finding, an older part of the brain, the periaqueductal gray, involved in down-regulating pain and enabling nurturant behavior in mammals. It's interesting. It's different from empathy networks in the brain, and it's also more of an older part of the nervous system, which I think is telling and in keeping with Darwin's thesis. That part of the brain is interconnected with oxytocin. You guys all know the oxytocin story? You know, who's heard of oxytocin? That's great. The most common question I get is, I've heard of it. That's what Rush Limbaugh was addicted to. I'm like, no, that's OxyContin, which is a stupefying painkiller. And wouldn't we love his show if he was addicted to oxytocin? But it promotes monogamy in certain voles. That's Sue Carter, Tom and Sel. You give it to different kinds of mammals. It triggers attachment-related behavior, caretaking in mammals. Famous study of Schmidt and others showing if in, I think it was Germany or Switzerland, where you can do this research. It's a little neuropeptide that floats into your brain and blood and is involved in breastfeeding and uterine contractions and all kinds of pro-social behaviors. In this study, you give oxytocin to people before they play an economic trust game, which you get money and you get to give some to a stranger. And what you find on the right is control saline solution, about 20% give their money away. If you whiff oxytocin, 50% of people give away the maximum amount of money. Here you go, man, you're my brother. I don't know you, but you know. I know you're thinking fundraising and business opportunities and marital propositions. I'll leave that to you guys. So that got Serena Rodriguez, who was in my lab, and Laura Saslow. Serena did postdoctoral work with Robert Sapolsky here at Stanford. There are polymorphisms, genetic polymorphisms, that are related to the functioning of the oxytocin system. We know very little anatomically about how, but we can start to study these temperamental markers. GG particular marker that relates to kind of more pro-social behavior in humans, this genetic marker on the third chromosome. In their work, they find you're more empathetic if you have this particular profile. We're just about to publish a study showing if I encounter somebody with this more pro-social genetic profile, within 20 seconds, as I watch them on the silent videotape listen to somebody talk about suffering, we trust those individuals and we pick it up right away. We can detect this thin slice of kindness, which is really interesting as we think about the evolutionary problem of strategically interacting with more cooperative types. As I turn the corner and head toward our discussion, you know, as I have done this science, and the reason why we have C-care is there, you bump into really cynical conceptions of human nature that I think this science calls into question. Sigmund Freud, the very emphasis of the commandment, thou shalt not kill, makes it certain that we are descended from an endlessly long generation of murderers. Is that what you would have inferred from having moral guidelines? I'm not sure. Ayn Rand, more influential than any social philosopher ever, perhaps, at least in the United States. You guys know who Ayn Rand's favorite student was? Who hung around Ayn Rand? Alan Greenspan. kid you not. Ayn Rand, in an essay in 1964, if any civilization is to survive, it is the morality of altruism that men have to reject. And that's why the video heading in today's talk is so essential, because we need to spread ideas about alternative principles rooted in the cultural wisdom of compassion and the evolutionary wisdom of compassion. Why many of you are here and what moved me is when you encounter other cultural traditions, you bump into different thoughts about human nature, such as His Holiness the Dalai Lama. If you want others to be happy, practice compassion. If you want to be happy, to practice compassion. And when you dive into Tibetan Buddhist philosophy, there is this sense, first of all, what a richer landscape of compassion in their icons and their practices and meditations. But there are claims that the resting state of the mind has a compassionate direction. So I care about this deeply because a lot of the broad survey data that you've probably heard about say we need the C-cares in the Greater Good Science Centers of the world because there's something of a compassion crisis, in particular in the United States. We know for 30 years of data, Americans are less empathetic and connected to the suffering of others than they were 30 years ago. We know children, Gene Twenge, are more narcissistic and self-focused than they were 30 years ago. We know young people are more materialistic than they were 30 years ago. These are big cultural shifts that we want to tilt the pendulum in the other direction. These are data from 1996. How much do you have faith and trust your fellow citizen? A lot of the collectivist cultures do quite well. The U.S. underperforms in terms of how much we trust. These are UNICEF data, really rigorous data from 2004, I think it is, assessing kind of the social connectedness of kids, great samples, six different measures that feed into the assessment of children. And what I weirdly represented this, the higher the bar, the lower the social well-being and compassion of the child. We rank 20th out of 21 countries on this index. You may pump your fist because we beat the British yet again, you know, but I don't. And you'll notice Holland always wins in the happiness context. There are parts of Amsterdam that are happier than any place in the world. And I'm not kidding. Those are scientific findings. And so this is why we need to make this a fight and bring it back. So as I head towards the end, I think there are constraints to compassion and methods of cultivation that we should really concern ourselves with. One of them that you heard about, I think from Michael Krauss, who is a student in my lab, doing a lot of work on inequality and social class. You guys know the story. We're at historic levels of inequality in the distribution of resources. You know, epidemiologists, psychologists, health scientists, no matter how you slice it, wherever you look in a society or a community or a neighborhood or a country, the more inequality, two things happen. The people who have a lot become disconnected to the suffering of others, which is what Michael's works on. And the people who don't have, their stress system jacks up and they don't have the capacity for as much compassion. Second, really interesting thing to think about is materialism. You know, it's almost trite to critique it, but the survey data on young people show it used about 30% 30 years ago felt like making a lot of money was the core reason for education in life. That's up to 72% now, right? And we know really neat studies like the more I think about money and I hear about these random fluctuations of the stock market all the time, the less compassionate I become and the less connected I am to other people. So those are some constraints that we should work against. And then, you know, we should be thinking about boosters of compassion. All kinds of metaphors are being floated around like, let's build the compassion gym or, you know, the compassion workout or the like. And I know C-Care and Philippe and others have been working on mindfulness and how there are a lot of good data showing that age-old practice of contemplation, thinking about the suffering of others, really shifts our emotion and physiological profiles towards more compassion. And then there are a lot of great data on how it spreads in families and communities, in neighborhoods, through making it a meme, right? As Karen Armstrong may have argued, right, and argues in The Great Transformation, that it has to become top of the mind and part of every conversation where you talk to your kids, you invoke the word, you talk to your friends, make it a regular, powerful practice, a cultural meme. We do a lot at the Greater Good Science Center. There's stuff outside that you can check into. I know some of you have already said you're kind of getting our website now has 250,000 unique viewers a month. There's a hunger for this. But please get in touch with us. We hosted a TEDx event. It's not here. The gym was part of about getting compassion out to educators. 700 educators were there. So lots of good stuff. So thank you very much.
Well, you know, it's interesting, and sometimes it's fascinating how profound some of the statements that the Dalai Lama makes. One of them is actually about health and being compassionate, and also obviously about being happy and being compassionate. It seems sometimes as though if we listened more to him and based our scientific studies off that, we'd all be perhaps in a better place. One of the things I wanted to ask you about also is you mentioned mindfulness, and obviously there are a number of individuals in this room who've done work in this. One of my observations, and I thought I'd get your thoughts on this, is that there are a number of mindfulness practices, and if you were to, let's say, completely secularize them and have a mindfulness practice, it seems as though even individuals who are Buddhists also have a mindfulness practice, and I know some very successful venture capitalists, but somehow the compassion part of it got kicked out. And it's fascinating because they're extraordinarily efficient, they're very focused, they can close their mind off and have a single point concentration, but the other part of it seems to have gone away. Do you have any, have you noticed that? Or
yeah, no, it's a, I think it's a justifiable form of skepticism, and it's interesting. Jon Kabat-Zinn came and presented on his stress reduction program at the Greater Good Science Center, and he said he really began the program trying to introduce compassion exercises, of which there are many, breathing exercises, imaging people, you know, loving kindness exercises, the kinds of things you guys are familiar with. He wanted to really teach people compassion, but the American public really latched onto the idea of stress reduction, right? Which is a separate enterprise. And I think you're right. I think we need to infuse these contemplative traditions with in the West with compassion. I think it's a fair critique.
I know you've also, getting back to this vagal nerve, it seems as though there are now actually training modules or devices that can let you self-regulate your vagal nerve tone. Can you comment on that?
Well, you know, I think it's so, I haven't studied them as interventions, but I think that's on the horizon, say, for kids suffering from autism or Asperger's or major episodes of depression. But I have a funny anecdotal story, which is what, you know, science often thinks it's doing one thing, and it turns out it's doing another. There's this baseline vagal tone technique where you want to get baseline measures of how your vagus nerve is operating. And it's kind of a mindfulness exercise where it involves breathing deeply to a nice tone in your lab. And my students kept coming to me and saying, well, actually, this isn't sort of a neutral state. This is activating the vagus nerve. And so I think this is a really easy practice. For those of you who have dealt with stressed out children, you'll notice it's in the breath right away, and changing the breath activates vagal tone. So I really look forward to the clinical tests of it as an intervention.
Hi, I've just read Edward O. Wilson's memoir, Naturalist, and in his studies on sociobiology, he notes that just about all species have compassion for those other organisms that they share the most genes with, the ones that are most closely related to, and less so with others. And I think you can see that in humans as well. People tend to be feel more empathy or to love better those who are the same race or same country as they are, same family, less so the further away you get.
Yep.
But and so that seems to be an evolutionary process. But obviously some people expand their range of compassion, and they tend to do so perhaps more often as they get older, so we can condition ourselves to develop a wider range of compassion. And it just makes, in my mind, it's very murky to what extent compassion is hereditary or genetic versus through conditioning.
You know, I mean, I think the first observation is essential, I wish evolution had crafted a Dalai Lama nervous system, but it did not. And there are a lot of data that are starting to show, as people have gotten really enthusiastic about, for example, oxytocin. And it used to be the hypothesis that this is the trust drug, and you just become devoted to any human being, It's like, you know, a Grateful Dead show or whatever it is, and you're giving away things, and life is in a great state thanks to this peptide. And there are new studies showing it's really sensitive to in-group, out-group distinctions, right? That it really makes you generous to people like you, or more specifically, who share your genes, as you say. And it doesn't have the same effects on those beyond your group categorization. And that's why Karen Armstrong is so important, because she says, you know, cultures are very energetic in devoting and teaching practices and cultivating practices that can, as Peter Singer, the philosopher, said, expand our circle of care, right? And we are incredibly capable of that. Humans, you know, my daughters weep when little harm befalls a sparrow, right? And it's like, you know, and that's built into our capacity as well. And so that's the challenge, is to focus on the practices that take this hardwiring and expand its reach. So,
what are Scandinavian countries doing right?
It is what are Scandinavians doing right, and they really do well in a lot of the happiness surveys. And you know, they have the strong social security system, free daycare, different views, and they have strong the consensus in the happiness literature. There are all these surprises. They're systematic surprises. Mexico and Guatemala do really well. Scandinavia does well. China in earlier times. It's communal connection. And once that's extracted, happiness falls. So
you could be like America.
Exactly. Yeah. Or, you know, it'll be interesting to see where China is as the massive economic, you know, markets have arrived and what it does to their social fabric.
Speaking of social fabric, it's sort of interesting because, you know, we now talk about all these social connections via social networks and the internet. Is that a falsehood or a chimera that we have this sense that there's this connection? So I was at dinner the other night and six people were at a table, all six were texting. Not a single one of them was talking for 20 minutes. I watched this.
Yeah.
And they're sitting there with their drinks, having dinner together, but not a word is spoken between any of them. So is that social connectedness?
Yeah.
Or what has happened here? Or is our destiny to live in a virtual reality here?
I'll see you there.
Second one.
Right, no. No, you know, it's we need good empirical science on this, and I think, you know, in the connection literature, I think you have to take very seriously there are different forms of social connection, and one is this sense of the 100 people that are with me, right, my tribe. And I think social networks give you that, and it's probably very robust at that. And obviously, for a person who studies touch and voice and smells and, you know, eye contact and little mist in the eye and whatever it is, it doesn't give you that. And it's very interesting to think about some recent theoretical papers on just the power of face-to-face eye contact in, you know, and we've known this in the attachment literature with kids, but how essential that is to empathy and social understanding and simulation of other people's emotions. And I think these are going to be some of the things that we lose at cost.
So how do we change the cycle so that our thinking ultimately leads to thinking of compassion? Changing the language that we use. And maybe does this relate to negative emotion?
Well, I'll give you a couple of examples. You know, one is, and they're both Stanford related, and my Berkeley, exactly, you know. One is our dear friend Lee Ross, and he set up, Lee Ross, who's a professor of psychology, who set up a study, people come to play, you can either be competitive or cooperative. If you call it the Wall Street game, you sharpen your teeth and you get really competitive. And I hope you saw, there's a recent study out in the last couple of days, bond traders are more aggressively competitive than sociopaths. So there you go. And they dominated our culture for 20 years. And if you call the game the community game, you're twice as cooperative. That is one word that changes the game. So I think we do have to change, in George Lakoff's way, the frame of how we look at things. That's why Phil Zimbardo is working on reconceptualizing heroism. You know, we kind of think heroism is for Greek gods and so forth, making it every day, right? That it's just everywhere. And that's why I'm thrilled by the science we do, and what I write about in Born to Be Good is like, boy, once you really look at the scientific markers of compassion, it is all over the place. And we just have to build upon that.
Just to reemphasize the work that Phil Zimbardo is doing, we actually fund some of that work, and we're really excited about this concept that it really should not be unusual to be a hero. And by hero, meaning to look at another person who is suffering and intervene. This really should be a natural response we teach to our children and elevate them when they demonstrate these types of behaviors. I always say, no matter our station in life, no matter our situation, even no matter how sad we are that day, every one of us has the capacity to help someone every day. And it can be simply seeing somebody as you're buying your coffee who doesn't seem to be particularly happy and greeting them and saying encouraging words, to a fellow on the street who clearly just might need a hello. But it is extraordinary, those simple interactions, not only do they benefit those individuals, but when you engage in them, they actually really benefit yourself. One other question I wanted to ask you, since you're from Berkeley, is about drugs. we've had some conversations about MDMA and sort of have been kicking around an idea of possibly using that in the context, not only for just pleasure, but scientific research. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Like, is my parole officer in the audience? Or, you know, we need this, and this will help. You know, the scientific answer is this will help us understand, you know, where compassion, aesthetic rapture, all these great states, you know, how to get at them, the circuitry, because it's hard. We in our lab are studying what people believe to be life-changing, transcendent experiences. And this is very common. And so, you know, the scientific perspective is, does this reset your vagus nerve in some fashion for an enduring period of time? How do you draw on that experience? Because we know it's true. So
if you don't know, MDMA is ecstasy. So if you've ever been to a rave, I've been to many.
Jim, where are we going with this?
Seriously now. you're at Stanford. Any other? Go ahead, sir. Speak loudly and I'll just repeat.
I've never been to studies about the role of compassion in business, because most people here are about business, here in Silicon Valley. But I do see a big role for compassion.
Yeah.
Instead of just competition and kill your competition.
Yeah.
Is there any studies on it?
Well, the thing that I teach, and it's good to see you again, is that there are a lot, you know, this again is where we bump into cultural misconceptions, which there are many different kinds of data that show that in organizations, we give power and leadership and trust to compassionate individuals. I know it sounds hard to believe, but there are tons of data on this, and there are also really excellent findings coming out from Stéphane Côté up at Toronto, that the more compassionate the business leader, the more productive the organization. It's just this magic ingredient. And there are even new analyses, you may have seen the recent Atlantic Monthly, that if you find cities like Palo Alto, where the kind of the magic ingredient for cultural innovation is connectedness and social intelligence and compassion. So there's some peripheral findings in the scientific literature, and I think it's really the task of the entrepreneurs to push it. So,
well, you know, it's interesting. I've been in some conversations over the last several months with a number of these young entrepreneurs who have been quite successful, and it's interesting the contrast, because I have a background of being involved in entrepreneurship and venture capital. And there was a time when there was a subgroup of people I dealt with in that arena who, to me, and you know, as a physician, my natural tendency is not to be absolutely ruthless. But you know, when you interact with them, it's like an incredible different worldview. And it's interesting because it took me some time to not get like just appalled and angry and upset, to get into a different sort of mindset. But within this new group of people, there seems to be really a great desire to not only have connectedness, to do thoughtful social good, and to really think about that. And I've spent some time with these individuals, and really it decreases my own state of natural cynicism, you know, when I interact with those people. In addition, I'd just like to comment about, you were talking about business, but certainly I do think that restoring compassion into the medical profession is really critically important. And it's absolutely true, and Dak and I have talked about this. I have observed myself, you know, medical students start incredibly idealistic at the start of their training because they have this idealized view of what a physician is. And then the mechanism of the training is such that it really, it just takes it out of them just to survive, and it's very painful, the situation they're in. So we're trying actually to work on some mechanisms to hopefully help with that in the healthcare environment. It's interesting, I recently spoke at the medical school I graduated from at Tulane. They have a white coat ceremony. And what the purpose is you get a white coat, you take the oath of Hippocrates or a similar type of oath, and then theoretically there's an inspiring individual who represents the ideals of medicine. So for that, this last year, it was kind enough that I was invited to do this. And you know, one of the things I said that, and I try as best I can to go by this, when you're in medical school, you have a lot of, you try to think of number or letter lists to remember, like groups of veins or arteries or stuff like this. And one of the things I said in this talk, which I tried to have guide myself, is I said to these students, you should just remember part of the alphabet. And that's C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L. And that is compassion, dignity, equanimity, forgiveness, gratitude, humility. That's hard for a neurosurgeon, too. Integrity, justice, and love. And if you can remember those things in your everyday life, I think that will get you through pretty well. And I think that's pretty much all of our time. Thank you.
From Dr. Dacher Keltner. And if you want to see more about his work and the work of the center that he is at, go to greatergood.berkeley.edu/author/Dacher, D-A-C-H-E-R underscore Keltner, K-E-L-T-N-E-R. Or you can just look up Greater Good, the Science of a Meaningful Life. And that about wraps up another edition of Savage Science Radio here at Jackalope 105 FM. And I would like to thank Nick Palucco for the beautiful show graphics, Dennis Bond and Hawk Productions for that fantastic intro we use every single week, and Todd Sheets, our executive producer and owner of Jackalope 105 FM. Until next week, keep your powder in your pants dry, and happy trails to you.
Times are strange, here I come, but I ain't the same. Mama, I'm coming home.